Tēnā koutou, welcome to season 5 of the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. I'm Karen Hay. The writers this season have spent decades in the pursuit of creativity and the art of writing, encountering resistance and criticism, personal tragedies, praise and success. It's going to be a great season. I'm glad you can join us. In 2019, Deborah Shepherd travelled to England to spend 2 days recording the oral history of writer Fleur Adcock. In the last episode, Fleur talked about some of her life in New Zealand, including the publication of her first poetry collection, The Eye of the Hurricane. By the time her second collection, Tigers, was published, Fleur was living in London, her permanent home now for nearly 50 years. Deborah asked Fleur how she felt when that second book came out.
I was at the writing group, the group. Mm-hmm. One of the people who came along was a young poet called Kevin Crossley Holland. You may have heard of him. He writes a lot of things for children and folk tales and children's operas and so on, and he's a poet. And he was working for Hutchison in a very junior capacity, and he said, oh, you must send us a manuscript. So I thought, all right, that's an excuse to get some of my poems sorted out and make a selection. And so I made this selection, and I got advice from George Macbeth, who was also another poet who was a member of the group. He worked for the BBC. He was very, very powerful in poetry, broadcasting and publishing. And so we sat down in the pub one lunchtime and went through The Eye of the Hurricane, and he read it and he said, well, leave this one out, put this one in. Yes, no, tick, tick, tick. That one went down and picked about half of them out. And I took his advice about which ones to include in Tigers. And then the other half of Tigers was made up of new poems that I'd written since I'd been here. And so that was a bit more sort of considered compilation.
And then with your...
And then I gave it to Kevin, and Kevin being so junior, really, he had sort of slightly saturated his power. And he passed it onto the higher-ups, and they said, no, thank you. The book came back from Hutchinson, and I thought, well, now that I've gone to the effort of typing it all out, I'll send it somewhere else. So I thought I should send it to Oxford University Press, which had published Baxter and Curnow and I think some other New Zealand poet, and there was Dan Davin was there. He wasn't at the University Press, the branch of the commercial branch that published things like poetry. He was at the Clarendon Press, but he was always called in as an advisor about poetry. And so they showed it to him as a reader. And anyway, they decided to accept it. So that was all right.
That was great.
And that was John Stallworthy, J-O-N, Jonathan, John Stallworthy, was the poetry editor at that point. And he had a New Zealand connection too. He had a cousin in New Zealand and relatives in New Zealand. And he liked it, so they published it. I went down to the Oxford University Press bookshop. They had a bookshop in Charing Cross Road, so all their new publications were in the window. So there it was in the window, so I had that classic thing of going in and seeing it in the shop window and then seeing reviews coming out. And they didn't do many book launches and things in those days, but they did have a launch party for several of their poets together. That was nice.
Mm. Mm. And nice because it was 3 years, wasn't it, since you'd arrived? And I think you said somewhere that it was like starting all over again.
Well, it was.
A completely
nobody
different
had heard
country.
Of me. The thing that helped me, the thing that introduced me to the world was the group. Mm. Because several of the poets who belonged to the group had positions with publishing or literary broadcasting. George Macbeth, who was in charge of broadcasting poetry at the BBC. Anthony Thwaite was poetry editor for The Listener. There was somebody else who had a little magazine. That was Howard Sargent at Outpost. So people, when I did my first session at the group, when I took in my 6 poems, I had...
Did you have to be invited to be a member?
Somebody took you along, usually. Right. So it was Hubert Witherford. I met Hubert Witherford at a reading by William Empson, who is a big name, you know, 7 Types of Ambiguity. And he was still alive, long whiskery beard, like a Japanese sage. And he did this poetry reading, and Hubert was there. And I knew him from Wellington. He was a friend of Alistair's, and he and his wife, Noel, had been over here for a while. So he said he went to this thing called the group and would I like to come along? He wasn't a very regular attender at the group. It was just something he knew about and he soon left it. But he introduced me and then I stayed. And so after a few months, then I sent Teddy some poems and some of them were published. They were from the book, which nobody had seen because it was a New Zealand book. And the three of them were new ones, I think. And I wrote in my equivalent of that little brown exercise book, Succès Fou at the group, and everybody loved them and all snapped them up and raved about them. So then I stayed. It was ending.
Could it also have helped you in a way, being new and unknown, and but the fact that these were quite polished?
Yes, must have, I suppose. But there weren't many people, women there. It was incredible. Mm. When I look back, the dearth of women is just... People nowadays would say, where are they? Or they wouldn't recognise the landscape. Mm. Mm. Like now, in Parliament or anything like that, the women used to be just an occasional little face. And so I can name the women. Somebody is writing a thesis about them, Samantha Morrish from Reading University. She gave a talk about my connection with the group at a symposium that they did about me at Winchester. Oh, and in particular, you were asking me, weren't you, talking about my women's anthology for Faber. Those three top poets, those weren't my choices, those were Craig's choices. Ah. He was the editor at, I saw him last night at this party.
Sylvia Plath was not...
Sylvia Plath.
Marianne Moore.
And...
Elizabeth Bishop?
Elizabeth Bishop, that's right. I liked Elizabeth Bishop's poems, but I didn't know her work very well. I didn't really know Americans terribly well.
Was that a useful project for you then?
Oh, terribly useful.
Yes.
But that was much later, you see. Yes. That was 1986. And it was just when people were beginning to publish anthologies of women's poetry, sometimes poetry over the ages, sometimes poems in certain sectors. But I thought 20th century women's poetry. And that's what it became, the Faber Book of 20th Century Women's Poetry. And then Craig said, well, of course, we'll start with Emily Dickinson because she was really a 20th century poet. And I said, no, she wasn't. She was dead. So he liked to be in charge. And he said, well, all right, in that case, you must have 30 pages each of the big three, Plath, Moore and Bishop.
Right.
And I said, no, I couldn't really do that. And Marion Moore wrote these long, long poems, so you'd only get about, half a dozen to 30 pages. But Plath, 30 pages of Plath, it was half a book.
Yes.
And I said, everybody's read her. She's all over the place. She's completely overexposed. Nobody needs any more Plath. What I want to do is bring out the people who've been neglected, all the neglected women poets, of whom there were so many lurking around in libraries and... back shelves of bookshops. And so then he sort of compromised and said, well, we'll have 30 pages instead of 30 poems. That's right. The original thing was 30 poems by everyone, 30 poems by Marion Moore. There wouldn't be no room for anybody else. So he settled for 30 pages. So I had to put in all this Plath, much against my will, and I don't admire her sufficiently. She was very interesting, and I did admire her, and I discovered her in Dunedin in a copy of the London Magazine, which the excellent University Library subscribed to, and read a couple of poems of hers and went along to the university bookshop. And I ordered a copy of her first book, The Colossus, first edition, dust jacket and all, got it in that filing cabinet over there. It's worth a great deal of money. I don't think there are any on the market now.
Did it speak to you, the poetry, then?
And she was writing differently. This was her first book of poems. She was influenced by people like J.K. Ransom and Theodore Rutke, and quite different poets. And she wasn't so over-emotional and hysterical and all those things that she wasn't quite so mad. And it wasn't that I didn't admire all her later poems, the aerial poems, but she just was extraneous to my view of what I wanted to reveal to the public. I wanted them to discover people who had been ignored. Mm. So anyway, Craig and I had a lot of arguments. And we'd sit down and I'd show him a poem by Loris Edmond, for example. Yes, I showed him a poem by an Australian poet, and he read it in a cod Australian accent so that it sounded totally ridiculous, and I thought, you're quite right, can't publish that.
But you did have a number of New Zealand poets in it, didn't
you? I put in
you
as much as I could. But
Robin Hyde as well?
Yes, yes. But I had a very limited page number. So somebody went out, somebody else.
Did you have Ursula Bethel too? Ursula
Bethel. Yes, I had all the ones I wanted to have, but not as many poems by then, because all these pages were stuffed with Plath and Marianne Moore and Bishop. I don't suppose there's anything I would have wanted to exclude from Elizabeth the Bishop. Then there were lots of things that I wanted to include that were not included. It wasn't just the quality, it was the justice, the balance.
And then, of course, you produce it, and then you can't please everyone as well, can you? I'm sure you would have. It would have provoked responses from women poets themselves, yes, as to why was I left out, or
yes,
why was that person not included?
Oh, Jenny Joseph. Jenny Joseph wrote this most famous poem, everybody's favourite poem, When I Grow Old, I Want to Wear Purple. And she hated it. She's just died quite recently. She just hated it for the rest of, ever since she wrote it, and it was so much loved, anthologised, copied, overexposed. So I had to pick that one, because I knew Craig wouldn't forgive me if I didn't, and I picked another one. So there were two for some balance. And he took one look at the other one and said, oh, no, we're just going to publish this one because it's so much better than me. And Jenny was furious, and she wrote me a sort of angry postcard with the pen going through the... Thank you for including my poem, but why did you choose that one? And I had to write back and explain it wasn't me, it was Craig, and I couldn't beat him down. Anyway...
Was there anything that you absolutely put your foot down over with him?
Well, I put my foot down quite a lot, and we came out fairly even a lot of the time, because I'm bossy too, and he thinks he's bossy, but I'm an older sister. Older sisters are bossy. So I argue, and he was a good friend, and I could argue with him. He wasn't somebody I was in awe of, but he used to keep saying, well, look, my shoes are wearing out, and my salary's on the line, and Faber was short of money. This has got to be a success. Faber, the only money that kept Faber going during those years was from Cats, from the musical, from the T.S. Eliot poems. All through the 80s, there's just been a history of Faber that's come out, and it was Cats that kept the coffers filled for all those years.
So did the book of 20th century women poets do well?
Yes, it did well, yes. I sold thousands and thousands.
Because that was the feminist wave then, wasn't it? It was the time that all the books were coming out, Virago and...
And Jackie, my editor at Oxford University Press, when I said I'd got a cheque for £1,100, she said, £1,100? You don't mean 110. No, it's not £1,100 royalties from this paperback.
Mm.
But it didn't last for very long. That was but that was good.
Mm.
And I got invited to do lots of work because everybody knew this anthology.
Had it helped that you'd done an earlier one for New Zealand, the Oxford University Press?
Well, that was quite a completely different experience in all sorts of ways, yes.
In what way?
Craig wasn't involved for a start. It was Anne French. And again, there were sort of difficulties. And I ran away and escaped the country. I went over there for 5 months and I stayed in my father's house, Father and Iris' house on the Oriental Parade. Anne had written to me from Oxford University Press and asked if I'd like to do it, so I arranged to go, and it was just after I'd finished my fellowship in Newcastle, so I was a sort of free agent, and so I went over there and joined the public library, which was very nice, and became a proper Wellingtonian and went on the buses and into the library and read all the books and met all the people and chose lots of poems, but again, I got into a lot of rows because everything gets personal in New Zealand. It's so small and gossipy, and everybody has axes to grind and delicate sensibilities. And it was I had a big row with Alistair about that.
Did he feature in it?
Yes. I put in his Te Rapaha sequence, but I didn't put in all of them. I left a couple of sections out to reduce it so that I'd have more pages. And I wouldn't do it now, but I thought, oh, well, I'm the editor. And of course, he was furious, but I'd gone. He didn't know. I'd left the country by then. He didn't see it until he got the letter from the editor. And then he hit the roof, poor Alistair. He won, of course. In the second edition, the whole poem was in. They suddenly found they were able to publish more pages, oddly enough. I didn't put in a great many women because I didn't admire the women poets who were writing then. Or some of them, Jan Kemp, for example. I wasn't greatly struck by Jan Kemp, who became a friend later.
Yes,
but,
yes, she took that beautiful portrait photograph of you, didn't she?
She became a friend, but I just didn't think she sort of hadn't got there very much. She was doing a lot of other important things, like compiling those records, recordings of New Zealand poets, archive poets. It was a wonderful thing to do. But her actual poetry, it had to be good. That's my only criterion for something in an anthology is it's got to be good.
And how do you define good? Because that's your own subjectivity, is it not?
It's good, good of its kind. Doesn't necessarily have to be my cup of tea. It just has to be good
of its kind.
So a lot of the ones in the women's anthology were not exactly my cup of tea. If they were too much, not my cup of tea, but they were just sort of mad rantings and ravings and hysterical sort of beat type stuff, then they wouldn't have qualified.
I'm Karen Hay, and this is the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. We'll be back to the podcast in a moment, but we want to remind you that the NZSA is the professional representative body which lobbies for the rights of all authors in New Zealand. NZSA will be representing writers in the ongoing reviews of the 2019 Copyright Act and campaigning for a stronger public lending right. NZSA collaborates across the sector to raise the visibility and discoverability of local books and local writers. To learn more about these important issues and to find out how to become a member, visit authors.org.nz. Most of Fleur Adcock's adult life has been spent in England. Deborah Shepherd visited Fleur in London in 2019, and they talked about how Fleur made a life there, starting with her first job at North London Polytechnic. We drop into the conversation with Fleur reading a poem by that name.
Mr. Yescom explains my duties. One will be to open what he calls the post. He means the mail. He introduces my new colleague in the vast pink overall who will show me around the library. Then, making conversation, he assumes that I'll be wanting to visit Scotland soon. I simper politely. No, why Scotland? All I want is to wallow in the charms of England regained after 16 years. Meanwhile, if I walk to the next but one bus stop on the way home, I'll save enough to buy either the Radio Times, bliss that it's not the New Zealand Listener, or a loaf of bread. I'll decide which later. So I was totally hard up. I had nothing except a trunk full of household equipment. I brought stuff like saucepans and sheets and towels. And of course, it was coming by boat. You just put everything in. I had Barry Crump's cast-off typewriter, which he gave me as a remarkable gesture of generosity.
But you came and you were determined to make a life here, though, despite it being really difficult. You didn't have second thoughts at the beginning?
No. I wanted to get the hell out of New Zealand, and I did.
So back to your work as a librarian, and then along came the residency, the first residency, which was the one at the Ambleside, Writer in Residence at Charlotte Mason.
71. That was a long, long time later. Before that, I'd been living two lives because I'd been doing things like Arvon courses, these creative writing courses, which are a wonderful institution, and I would have to take time off from my annual leave, and a course lasted a week. So a week off from that, I wasn't getting holidays. I was doing things like that instead.
Yes.
And
so your career as a poet.
So
was,
I was building up all the contacts and doing the readings and
consolidating.
And I would take a half day now and then. If I had a poetry reading in somewhere out of town, I'd have to take the afternoon off and go there and get back. A lot of travelling in.
How many books of poetry did you publish in that time frame of the years of the paid work? Because
not many at all.
No. So you left. So well, you went full time in 1979. In that time.
So Tigers 1967. Yes. High Tide. I just have to look at the list of publications. I just don't remember these things off by.
I've got them.
It's probably here too.
So, and then there was the scenic route in 74, yes. And then the inner harbour in 79, and the below.
Yeah.
Is it, how do you say that?
Below Loughrigg. That's a pamphlet. That was when I was actually at living in Ambleside. That Loughrigg is the fell that you see from the window in Ambleside. It's a Norse name. So there was Tigers, High Tide, Scenic Route, and then your inner harbour.
Four.
No, the inner harbour actually, 1979, I had already gone. I think it was just Tigers, High Tide, and the Scenic Route. There wasn't so much time to write.
No,
you see,
well, of course.
Because not only was I working, but I did have a child, and Andrew was away at boarding school from the age of 11. But even so, there was a lot to fit in.
The decision to leave the full-time work and be right full-time, and did the being on that residency at Ambleside, was that a factor in the decision-making that you took the time out to do that?
Yes. Totally transformed my life. But it was the best year of my life. It was the happiest year of my life ever. Mm.
And what made it so happy?
Everything. Mm-hmm. I was out in the country, travelling, wandering around, looking at nature. Nature is my basic thing, and like creatures and plants and birds and insects and wildflowers from the time I was a child, and tadpoles and frogs. And it wasn't the large-scale nature. It wasn't big, beautiful mountains and views. It was the small-scale nature of finding a bird's nest or a pond with some tadpoles in it or an interesting plant in the garden. And then I was free to write. I didn't have to get up and go on the tube to work every morning. I didn't have to go. I had to wander over to the college. I used to go over about 10 o'clock when they had coffee break and talk to some of the staff at coffee time and then see students and do things. And then I would be climbing around the woods and the fells, Skelgill Wood, and I had lots and lots of friends, and I invited all my poet friends up to do readings because the college liked to make itself a centre of excellence in the community, so they'd have all these poetry readings. So I tried to bring people who would impress them, like I got Ted Hughes to read at one reading, I got Tony Harrison, I got friends like Anne Stevenson and Kit Wright, and so it was very sociable, and I had a lot of friends there. And then all my family came over, sort of one by one. My mother came over and she stayed with me for a bit. Andrew was at LSE. He came up with his girlfriend at Easter, and we walked around watching the lambs scampering around with their long waggly tails. And then Gregory came over with Elizabeth and stayed for a week. And Angela, my friend Angela Carter, came up for a few days from Sheffield, where she was.
Yes.
I had a similar residency.
And so it was a whole year of this.
A whole year. And 11 months.
And a stipend.
Yeah. Then I had to go back to the bloody library. And it was like going back to prison. I felt like a recidivist who's done something, who's lapsed and accidentally sort of burgled a jeweller's and back behind bars again. So I was determined to get out again. And
so,
I looked at all the fellowships that were advertised in the TLS, and the one in Newcastle came up. And that was 2 years.
Mm.
And to my utter delight, I got that.
So on the residency, did you have a specific project you were working on?
No. I was just glad if I was able to write a poem.
Yes.
You're always just glad if you can write a poem. The only time I ever envisaged a book as one unity was the land ballot, when I sort of set out to do that. And I didn't set out to do it until I'd written four or five poems already that referred to my father's teenage years there, and I suddenly thought, ooh, this looks as though it might be going to turn into a book, and then I sort of planned it. And even then, it wasn't a very finished, polished plan. It was just whatever comes along. But before that, you write a poem, and after a while, you find you've got a folder full of poems, and there might be 30 or 40, and you look through them and think, does this look as though it might form a book? And so they could be from any dates. River's quite an early one. River's about the... It's from a book in the Colonial Office Library by Mungo Park. It was called Travels in the Interior District of Africa or something like that, which was a revelation. Imagine going into this unknown world where no European had been before. Mm. And I remember the line, in a certain kind of astonishing silence. That was a poem that had, based on something that, a really revelatory book, the Mungo Park's book.
Is there anything from that volume that you'd like to read? That...
Well, I could read that, couldn't I?
Yes.
Although it's very short. It comes up with an epigraph, a quotation from Mungo Park, travels in the interior districts of Africa. And he says, "I saw with infinite pleasure the great subject of my mission, the long-sought-for majestic Niger, glittering to the morning sun, as broad as the Thames at Westminster and flowing slowly to the eastward." He thought it was going to be flowing west towards the sea, but it turns around, you see. So he was mind-boggled to see that. So the poem is, "The strong image is always the river," was a line for the poem I never wrote 20 years ago and never have written, of the green Whanganui under its willows, or the ice-blue, milky, foaming Clutha stopping my tremulous teenage heart. But now when I cross Westminster Bridge, all that comes to mind is the Niger, a river Mungo Park invented for me, as he invented all those African villages, and a certain kind of astonishing silence, the explorer having done the poet's job, and the poet feeling gratefully redundant.
So that was something that came out of the work there that you
work
discovered.
In the library. Yes. Oh, yes, everything's grist. I wrote quite a lot of poems in the library. I wrote The Ex-Queen Among the Astronomers, which gets anthologised a lot. And I was sitting, by that time I was in the reference section, much more interesting, answering queries and written inquiries. And so I could sit at my desk and I could go over and pull out the astronomy volume and have a little read and started thinking about what astronomers do, and then it got into the poem, which was about something altogether else, but it greatly enriched it because vocabulary and information is what you want in poems.
Yeah. The appeal of residencies for you, you've had three? There was one in Adelaide that didn't last. You did,
no,
that was
it
brief.
It didn't last. It was just, that was what I was appointed for. It was just when I went to the, every year at the Adelaide Festival, they pick one of the writers who's coming to the festival and they offer them a term, 12-week residency. And I got picked that year, so that was just, they let me choose what time I wanted to come because I didn't want to be there straight after the festival when it would be 41 degrees and I couldn't stand it. So I arranged to have it fitting in with a trip to New Zealand, so I had my air ticket was a trip to Australia with a holiday in New Zealand in between. So I went to the festival, then I went off to New Zealand for several weeks with the family, and maybe 6 weeks or something there, and then went back to Adelaide when it was getting more towards autumn and winter, and then I did my 12 weeks there.
And what happened on that residency?
I wrote a lot of poems, I made an awful lot of friends, and what happens everywhere, it's very sociable, and you really do make friends. You bond with people when you're in that situation. My friend Jan Owen is a very good poet. I made friends with her and we're still in touch. And she comes over here occasionally and we write to each other.
There's a poem writer in residence where there's a line where you mention that the experience being inspiring and inhibiting.
Oh, absolutely. That was going to Amazon. I arrived in Ambleside. And people said, "Have you written any poems yet?" Well, it's of course I bloody haven't. I've just arrived. You don't write poems when you're doing all this social stuff, and writing poems is what you do when you're alone. Mm-hmm. And it's precisely the opposite of what they expect you to do in a residency when you're getting interviewed by all the newspapers, who are quite often hostile, the local newspapers. Poet paid $5,000 a year to work one day a week, I think they said, or something like that. But because they thought I'd be only working one day a week. Mm. I was available. I'd sit in my office and then,
yes.
Anyway.
Yeah.
And after a while, things settled down and I did all the walking around. And then I started by exploring and walking. I would make the discoveries that led to the poems.
So where do you like to write best of all?
It doesn't matter as long as I'm alone. Mm. Or it doesn't matter even if I'm on a train, as long as nobody's talking.
Mm-hmm.
Now that everybody talks on their mobile phones, that's not very good. But mm-hmm. No, it doesn't matter. I just need to get started. And so a lot of it is when I'm walking around. So I just go out and head for the woods or just walk around the block or whatever and stop when a line comes into my head and scribble it down, or else revise something, walk along thinking, there's something wrong with that third line. I think I need to change that adjective because it's got too many syllables in it, and you're doing all this work in your head as you're walking around. I can't do it when they put you into a room and say, okay, go ahead and write. That isn't a poem, that's an exam. I was once involved in the thing where they were wanting poets to write poems based on the 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock news on television and what was going on. I said, I can't do that. I can't sit in this room and write a poem about something. I'm sorry, I've got to go home. And I dashed onto the tube and galloped off home. I don't think it had to be the evening news, but you know, I came home and wrote something. When I was in Newcastle, that was also a very rewarding time because I knew a lot of people and I was doing a lot of interesting work. And
that was traveling. What followed immediately on from the Ambleside.
Yes.
That was the 2 years at the universities of Newcastle upon Tyne and Durham?
And Durham, yes.
Yes.
So very separate universities,
yes,
of which the English departments didn't get on. They didn't communicate with each other.
So did you spend one year with one and one the other?
No. It was a week.
Just an oval.
I was living in Newcastle because it was a much more fun place to live and I had lots of friends there. And I had a wonderful university flat, huge. And then on Tuesday mornings, I'd get on the train and go to Durham. Train at about 10:15, and Durham was the next station, only took a quarter of an hour to get there. And then I'd go and sit in somebody's office in the English department and wait for people to come and consult me or do things that I'd arranged to do.
So this was good for your...
the cathedral.
This was good for your career.
Oh, yes, it's all...
Yes, because lots of things would come out of it.
Yes.
Yes.
It's all very rewarding in every way.
Yes.
It's very rich.
So was it on that residency that you thought actually it might be possible to give up the job?
I'd already decided. As soon as I got back to my desk and the, mm-hmm. I was so depressed that the boss let me go home early when I had my first day back in the library. I just couldn't believe that I was back in this full-time employment. And I went home early. I had my mother staying with me and Sarah, I think. I came in, they let me go home early. Oh, I can't stand it. So, yeah, I just determined
this time,
that was it.
Andrew was, he'd grown up.
Yes,
and so
yes, exactly.
You weren't having to support him as much.
Well, he was a student, but in those days, students got grants.
Exactly.
They weren't loans, they were grants. The less you earned, the more your student child would get. So it was in his interests for me to be on a lower income, but
it was at the residency that you met Gillian Whitehead, is that right?
I met her before I went up to Newcastle. Mm-hmm. I met her at New Zealand House. I think John Thompson introduced us. He knew her, of course, he was a musicologist, he knew everybody, and he introduced me to Gillian. Gillian was already composer in residence. These appointments were for 2 years, but hers, she was beginning her second year, so she'd had 1 year in Newcastle. I was about to begin my first year as writer in residence, and so he introduced us, and she talked, I think even then, before I got up there, she suggested that we might do something together. She'd had a commission to write something for a group called Gemini and a soprano, and so a song cycle or something of that kind, and I thought about it, and And I was writing stuff even before I'd, about the Roman wall, even before I'd ever set eyes on it. And I was just so excited about going there, thrilled a bit.
Mm. This was set then to, this was sung as a ballad.
Yes, yes. So and it was, she performed three times in, at that time, it was performed in Sunderland and somewhere else in the north and in New Zealand House. And the premiere was in New Zealand House. And so there was a big party and people all in New Zealanders all came along. And Gretchen Albrecht, who was a friend of Julian's, made banners for the performance. And they were
beautiful. That'd be gorgeous.
Mm.
Mm. And so this collaborative relationship was really quite significant, yes, because since 1980 it's continued.
We kept doing more.
Yes. So there was Eleanor of Aquitaine in 1982, mm, and then Out of This Nettle Danger.
That was based on Catherine Mansfield's journals. She quotes
really?
That. So it's based on her bits from her journals. I made a sort of collage of bits from her journals.
So is it really Letter pleasurable? King. Is this a really pleasurable thing, working with a composer?
It's fantastic. It's such joy. Yeah. All these things are such joy. Yeah. You have no idea. Yeah. Yes.
And it must be great pleasure in hearing it performed.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And because writing is, apart from when you were editing the anthologies, it's all writing critiques or... It's you do it in isolation, don't you? So the collaborative aspect of this,
it's
must
a different
be lovely.
Thing. It's not really about writing.
Yeah. But you like solitary, don't you?
Absolutely. It suits you. Yes, it's the only way to write. But I like commissions. I like being given something to write about. So commissions are very fruitful quite often because you don't know what you're going to write about, and somebody says write a poem about an endangered species for this anthology called The Orange Dove of Fiji, it turned out to be about. So I thought, right, you can't get much more endangered than being actually extinct. So I wrote about the moa, and I wouldn't have written that poem if I hadn't. So I looked up the books, and I was in New Zealand, actually. And
yes.
And no matter how much you may dislike it, like I was asked to write a poem for a pamphlet. There's a series of pamphlets called 10 Poems About This or That. So there's... email I just had was from a friend who's editing 10 poems about love, and I was asked to contribute to 10 poems about Christmas, making it feel positive. Well, I hate Christmas, so I don't feel positive about that. All I can say is I love singing the carols, but but it had to be amusing. Then I thought of an episode, something that occurred in connection with Christmas, which was when Alex and Meg were staying here, and we had Christmas dinner with them, and we all had a party afterwards, and a few of their friends came along, and we all ended up taking our clothes off. So that was very entertaining. And so they loved that, of course.
You've been listening to Fleur Adcock talking with Deborah Shepherd about her life as a writer, poet and editor. And it's the last episode of this season. Thank you for joining us and listening to some of New Zealand's greatest writers talk about their life and work. This podcast was produced by Elizabeth Kirkby-McLeod for the New Zealand Society of Authors, with audio support from Yana Tanahu Owen. Notturno by Ottorino Respigi, which you're listening to now, is performed by Justin Bird. I'm Karen Hay, and this was a New Zealand Society of Authors oral history podcast.